Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Working together, we can move beyond some of our old racial wounds. And that, in fact, we have no choice. We have no choice if we are to continue on the path of a more perfect union.
Barack Obama from his race speech earlier in the year. My first guest this hour, Brandeis University historian Peniel Joseph, author of Waiting for the Midnight Hour, A History of the Black Power Movement. Dr. Joseph, as some of you TV watchers may know, has been a regular PBS commentator during the election campaign and has been with us a few times as well. And Dr. Joseph, welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks for having me.
First, your reaction after doing all this analysis on PBS and here and elsewhere, just your own reaction to the election after following the campaign so closely.
Well, no, I think it was a watershed historical moment for all Americans and really for everyone around the world. I think even though all the polling data indicated that it wasn't going to be close and it turned out not to be, it still was really surrealistic to just see the first black president actually be elected. So it was a very interesting night historically, absolutely.
And in the context of your book, we've heard so much about sort of the straight line from Martin Luther King to Barack Obama. Is there also one from Angela Davis or Stokely Carmichael or Huey Newton to Barack Obama?
Well, yeah, I think so. I think one of the things that Obama did in his campaign was, and really his own persona, and I think you get this certainly in his book, Dreams from My Father, is the fact that he was very well aware of the legacies of both movements. He talks about the civil rights movement, but at the same time, he talks about finding inspiration in Malcolm X's autobiography and Malcolm's ability to reinvent himself. And he arrives in Chicago at the very point where Harold Washington has taken over as mayor. And he talks about meeting Harold Washington. He talks about the local political activists in Chicago and the black nationalists and Pan-Africanists in Chicago. He has a critique of them, but he's aware of their existence. And certainly Harold Washington was an extension of that both the civil rights and black power movement. So I do think that there's a direct line from not just only the civil rights movement to Obama, but the way in which in the 1970s and 80s we see the first generation of post-civil rights politicians who are really elected on a politics of racial solidarity. Now, Obama doesn't use that same paradigm, but he needed the existence of a Harold Washington and really even the Jesse Jackson campaigns of 84 and 88 to make this possible.
Everybody saw Jesse Jackson crying or saw clips of Jesse Jackson crying after the announcement of victory at Grand Park in Chicago at the big victory celebration on Tuesday night. Where does Jesse Jackson fit in?
Well, Jesse really is a bridge between the civil rights, black power politics of the 1960s and 70s, and then an attempt in the 1980s and 90s for African Americans to really become political power brokers in their own right. So sometimes we call it this transformation from protest to politics, but I really think it's an embrace of protest and politics, meaning that we think about the civil rights demonstrations to get the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act, but by the 1970s, what we see are a whole generation of black congressional leaders like Shirley Chisholm. We see a whole generation of black mayors. And we also see, you know, one or two national figures like an Edward Brooke, who's senator out of Massachusetts from 66 to 78. Douglas Wilder is the governor of Virginia in the late 80s. David Dinkins, mayor of a big city like New York, which is predominantly white. Tom Bradley is mayor of Los Angeles, which is predominantly white. And, of course, there's the so-called Bradley effect was the fact that in 82, Bradley was predicted to become governor of California. He was leading in all the polls and then lost a close race. But Jesse Jackson becomes a real national figure with the runs for president in 84 and 88. And surprisingly, Jesse tried to run as a race transcendent figure that America could not believe in Jesse Jackson. Because remember, in 1984, when Jesse addresses the Democratic National Convention in San Francisco, it's only 21 years since John F. Kennedy was killed, only 16 years since Martin Luther King Jr. and Robert F. Kennedy was killed. Jesse explicitly mentioned civil rights martyrs like Cheney, Schwerner, and Goodman, and Fannie Lou Hamer. The country was too close to the civil rights struggles of the 1960s. And we as we know, there was an impending cultural war that Pat Buchanan and others talked about in the 1990s that had yet to emerge in full bloom. So most white voters, even though Jesse got 3.5 million votes in the Democratic primaries in 84 and then close to 7 million in 88, nationally, he was not accepted as this race-transcending figure because he was too close to the civil rights movement. He was speaking in the cadences of the preachers of the civil rights movement.
So tone of voice matters. Barack Obama, not just his words, but how he speaks?
Oh, certainly. Obama, sometimes people have tried to compare him to a professor. I think he's more of a street speaker. So I think there's more, in terms of the cadences, it's more Malcolm than Martin, surprisingly, even though he tries to adopt the verbal rhetorical flourishes of preachers when he's in a black church, for instance. But it's definitely he runs cool rather than running hot, and I think that was pivotal in the acceptance of Americans, especially in the 5 months between the nomination and the election.
And when you write about the Black Power movement, and maybe since we're talking for part of our conversation in these historical terms, you might want to define what exactly you mean by Black Power. But you trace it back pre-Malcolm X, all the way to the 1950s and the rise of the original Nation of Islam.
Yeah, certainly. And by Black Power, basically, our working definition really is just the politics of radical self-determination, cultural, racial pride, and really connecting domestic civil rights struggles or domestic anti-racist struggles with international anti-colonial independence movements.
That's what you call Pan-Africanism.
Certainly, Pan-Africanism or Black internationalism, absolutely. And so when we think about Black Power in the 20th century, we can really trace it all the way back to Marcus Garvey and the UNIA. But certainly when we think about the 1930s and 1940s, Nation of Islam, Paul Robeson, these different black activists who really had a more militant perspective about racial equality. And by the 1950s, Malcolm X becomes the figure who bridges two generations, one generation that had grown up in the 1930s and 40s, and then a younger generation, people like Leroy Jones, Maya Angelou, the jazz singer Abby Lincoln, and then later the Black Panthers.
So if you're talking in terms of nationalism, I want to ask you in a minute if you think the election of Barack Obama is on some level the death of the Black Power movement or Black nationalism. But I want to set that up with a clip. You talk about the path through history of African Americans. Here is Barack Obama from his speech on race in Philadelphia in March, talking about that path.
For the African American community, that path means embracing the burdens of our past without becoming victims of our past. It means continuing to insist on a full measure of justice in every aspect of American life. But it also means binding our particular grievances for better health care and better schools and better jobs to the larger aspirations of all Americans. The white woman struggling to break the glass ceiling, the white man who's been laid off, the immigrant trying to feed his family. And it means also taking full responsibility for our own lives by demanding more from our fathers and spending more time with our children and reading to them and teaching them that while they may face challenges and discrimination in their own lives, they must never succumb to despair or cynicism.
And Peniel Joseph, history professor at Brandeis University, author of the book Waiting Till the Midnight Hour, which is a history of the Black Power movement. There definitely is some Black Power, traditional Black Power, Black nationalist language in there, funny enough, with the self-reliance. But obviously he represents something beyond that to so many white and non-black Americans.
Well, certainly. I think, you know, the whole notion when he says bind our grievances, that's straight out of W.E.B. Du Bois and the notion of closing ranks. During World War One, that blacks should join the fight for democracy and really close ranks. And Du Bois even used the word, we need to really put aside our special grievances, and this is 1917. So when we think about Obama, one of the things that's interesting about Obama is that he really represents one strain of black power activism that sought access to the electoral arena. And when we think about that, black power, it's not just black nationalism and pan-Africanism or even people who are Marxists and class strugglers. It's feminists, it's liberal Democrats, it's trade unionists, it's high school students who are on strike in Los Angeles and Philadelphia and elsewhere. So when we think about Obama, I mean, there were black elected officials who felt that we needed an African-American president. And when the 1972 Black Political Convention in Gary, Indiana, was the first major effort in the post-war era to really craft the black political agenda at the national level. And the discussions there was whether or not to run a black person for president. Shirley Chisholm eventually ran for president that year, but she did it on her own. And then by 1984, Jesse Jackson took up that call. So what's interesting about Obama is that on one level, he represents the race-transcending aspects of the civil rights movement and really does talk in that soaring rhetoric of democracy. But even the audacity to run for president is based in that politics of black power and really self-determination and that confidence. Because remember, when he ran and announced the candidacy in February of 2007, I don't think most of your listeners would have thought that America was ready to elect an African-American president,
right,
period,
right.
Let alone the DNC or RNC was ready to nominate a black man to be president. So the very fact that he felt that confident to do that really bespeaks to a different conception of politics. And I've always argued that when we think about the black power movement, that's a movement that's also a movement to try and transform American democracy, and there's a universal impulse in that movement, even though it wants to redefine black identity as sort of this powerful signifier.
Do you think that there's anything left of the black power movement as you refer to it in your history? And does the election of Obama as a quote-unquote post-racial president, if you accept that term, signal the end of the black power movement in some respect?
Well, no, certainly I think the black power movement is alive and well in terms at the local level all across the United States. And I think there are national context to see it as well, whether we think of the State of Black America conferences where we see the book A Covenant with Black America that sold over 500,000 copies. I do feel that it's evolving. And there was that article in the New York Times a few months ago about, you know, does Obama signal the end of black politics? And my answer was always no, but is there an evolution going on in black politics? And the answer is yes. I think that following Tip O'Neill's famous maxim that all politics are local, at the local level, the politics of racial solidarity will continue to be robust. So if you're in the South Side of Chicago, for instance, or in parts of New York City that are predominantly Latino or predominantly black, your race and your ethnicity are still going to be a part of the equation, a big part of the equation in terms of getting you elected to a local city council or state representative or mayor of some cities whose racial configuration is predominantly Latino, predominantly African American, or what have you. At the national level, I think Obama has provided room for candidates who are running for, say, the U.S. Senate, candidates who are running for governor. We saw Deval Patrick in Massachusetts win the governorship, where we may see more African-American senators and governors at the national level. And certainly after an Obama administration, we're more likely to see more African-Americans and Latinos and women running for office or running for the presidency of the United States.
And what about Pan-Africanism? Obviously, the election of Barack Obama is such a big thing around the world. Is there anything to say in terms of Pan-Africanism that goes beyond our borders?
Oh, absolutely. I think this is a global election. And one thing I think most historians would agree is that we have never seen the outpouring globally or nationally in response to a presidential election in the United States in the history of the entire country. So in that sense, it's very, very historic. Obama was the president, presidential candidate who was seen by most Americans during a campaign in person in American history. No one has ever had those kind of rallies. Historians will say Ronald Reagan could bring 50,000 people out at the height of his popularity. But, you know, Obama was bringing 100,000 people out to St. Louis, 75,000 to Portland. This was really amazing.
Do you think there's an expectation out there that might not attach itself to other presidents-elect, that he say something now, for example, about the situation in Congo, where there's such an immediate crisis of hundreds of thousands of refugees and a war raging and the international community kind of standing by?
Well, I think there's going to be an expectation that's based on the politics of change that he ran on. And certainly, in terms of the aesthetic transformation that he represents in the democracy, just seeing him and Michelle and the kids, when things are raging in the third world or Africa, I think at least Pan-Africanists and African-Americans are going to have a kind of expectation. Whether or not the way in which he massages those expectations will be interesting to see, because, again, like he said during his victory speech, that, you know, he's going to be the president of all the people. So certainly he's going to have to pay attention to the nuances, especially when things are going on in places like Africa and genocide and Darfur. And he's spoken out about those things even as a senator. As a president, it's going to be interesting to see what his Africa policy is, what his policy towards the third world, his policy towards Haiti and the Caribbean is going to be, because I think there's a lot of expectations from those quarters.
So last question, and this kind of makes a transition to our next guest and our next topic, which is going to be personal stories of inspiration from the election of Barack Obama to do something in your community or in the world, however you define your community or the world. This is a clip of Chicago Sun-Times columnist Mary Mitchell on Meet the Press yesterday. Listen to this.
This morning I did a radio show, and the callers were up at 5 o'clock this morning talking about how excited and inspired they were, how they were going to go back and, you know, take this victory, not just celebrate Obama's victory, but celebrate the community. Get the guys off the corners. Get the kids in the school. Encourage your kids to go to school. I mean, they were talking about basic things they could do right now today to improve the quality of life in their own neighborhood.
Interesting to hear it taken to the neighborhood level like that. Any reaction to that and any historical context for that?
Well, I don't think there's a historical context. I mean, certainly Kennedy is the first Irish Catholic president, but I don't think it reverberated around the world or in around poor communities the way this is. I do think that the instant reverberation before an Obama administration can do any kind of public policy really is going to be in the hearts and minds of young people, but also community activists and organizers all across the country, because what we've seen unleashed Tuesday night is a tremendous sense of civic engagement and small d democratic participation in virtually every community in the United States, and especially the African American community can take advantage of that. I think we saw on one level this kind of excitement at a smaller level in 1995 in the aftermath of the Million Man March, where after that march, many African Americans joined NAACP and did a lot of community organizing. But certainly this kind of excitement dwarfs that, and I think potentially it's got real important reverberations where that notion of self-determination, and that's the link, again, between, even though the Obama administration would never say, okay, we're black powerites, but that notion of black nationalism, self-determination, self-reliance, to just get up and, you know, clean up your own communities. I think you're going to see that reverberate for quite some time in inner cities all across the country.
All right. Peniel Joseph, Brandeis University historian, author of Waiting for the Midnight Hour, and you're working on a new book, I understand. Is that right?
Yeah, the book is actually entitled From Black Power to Barack Obama, so that's coming out next year.
All right. So I hope you come back. It's always a pleasure to have you when the book comes out and maybe before. Peniel Joseph, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Brad.
And we will continue on that question. Has the election of President-elect Barack Obama inspired you to be more civic-minded, to do something as a volunteer locally or get more active in politics. Give us a call about the personal side of this for you as we'll talk to a guest who wrote an article on Huffington Post called Ask Not What Obama Can Do For You, Ask What You Can Do For Obama. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. What can you do for Obama and the country and your neighborhood after the campaign? 212-433-9692.